Your attention, please. The Thunder Mesa Limited, now leaving for a grand circle tour through the realms of Imagineering, Model Railroading, and Disney Trains. All passengers, board!
Howdy, folks! Welcome aboard the Thunder Mesa Limited. I am your host, Dave Meek, coming to you from Thunder Mesa Studio in historic Jerome, Arizona. Like the man says, this is the show where we talk to all kinds of creative folks from the worlds of Imagineering, modeling, trains, and most of all, Disney trains. You are listening to Season 1, Episode 1, and today we are very fortunate to have as our special guest, Jake Johnson. Jake is a former senior dimensional designer for Walt Disney Imagineering, as well as a professional model builder and kit designer. These days, he's busy working in motion picture and television production, and also as my business partner in Crescent Creek Models. But before we talk with Jake today, please have a listen to this important message from our sponsor.
After a hard day working in the mines, bring your gold dust to Big Thunder Saloon, the biggest little saloon in the West, with entertainment, dancing, billiards, and the finest corn whiskey west of the Rio Grande. Belly up to the bar for a refreshing libation, or try your luck at our gaming tables, where our square dealers almost never draw from the bottom of the deck. It's Big Thunder Saloon, right next to the SA office on Main Street. And hang on to them hats and glasses, because this here is the wildest rye in the wilderness.
And now, without any further ado, please welcome to the program, Jake Johnson. Hi, Jake. Thanks so much for doing this.
Howdy, Dave. It's great to have this conversation with you. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, that's good. You know, it's, a full disclosure, Jake and I know each other. We've been business partners for a couple of years, and he seemed like the natural choice to have on this very first episode, because he ticks all of the boxes. You know, we talk about Imagineering, we talk about model railroading, trains, Disney trains, and Jake ticks all of those boxes. And first, I want to talk. You know, let's go back. Let's go way back in time to the very beginning. You grew up in Southern California, just like I did, right?
Right.
All right. And you grew up in Orange County. Where
in Orange County? Theme park adjacent.
So Knott's and Disneyland and all that kind of stuff. So I want you to talk about who were your childhood heroes growing up?
So I had two childhood heroes, Walt Disney and John Wayne. And Walt Disney is obviously the Disney park. And I always felt like there was a tie-in with John Wayne at Knott's Berry Farm. John Wayne was a cowboy, and John Wayne was one of the first persons to go down the flume in the log ride back in the day.
Yeah, they had the John Wayne Theater there too, right?
John Wayne Theater, and I always remember seeing a bronze of John Wayne from True Grit that was fully painted about 12 to 15 inches tall, and it was just a cool thing to see. I'd never seen a painted bronze sculpture before, right. But that was one of those things. And, you know, my dad always took me to Westerns. So there's always been this interest in the West, and obviously theme parks and railroads and cowboys, all those kinds of things. But Walt,
What is it about us growing up in Southern California, about as far removed from the actual Wild West as you can get, you know, being so into, you know, cowboy movies and Frontierland and Knott's Berry Farm and all that kind of stuff. It's interesting. I mean, is it just watching all those Westerns on TV when you're a kid, you think?
I think so. I think you and I come from a generation where that was very accessible. We probably had cap guns as kids and chased each other around wearing cowboy hats. I started riding horses at a very early age, so that gets thrown into the mix. But you watch all these Western movies on TV, and then you go to a place like Disneyland or like Knott's Berry Farm, where this sort of full-size recreation of the Wild West right. exists there for you to walk through and interact with. it kind of pushes some buttons, and there's a response and, right. and a desire to explore more of that.
Right. Well, it was really like, I mean, the kids today, they don't understand, but you know, when we were kids, Westerns, that was the Star Wars of our generation growing up, mm-hmm. right? You know, that was like Star Wars is now. Yeah. So you grew up in Orange County and we went to Knott's Berry Farm and Disneyland. Knott's back in the day when you could just walk right in off of Beach Boulevard. Remember that? There was no admission gate or anything. You just walked in and you paid for each individual ride.
Right, right, yeah. right. What a difference as opposed to the all day pass.
Right.
The ticket booths. Right.
I tell people, yeah, it was like $1.75 to get into Disneyland when I was a kid. And they're like, what? No. Yeah. Yeah. But that didn't include tickets. But anyway.
So, yeah, and there were ticket booth shacks at the parks.
A lot of them are still there at Disneyland.
Those upsell tickets.
Right. Yeah. We used to go and pay the admission and buy a D ticket and then go and hang out on Tom Sawyer Island all day and, you know, eat Fritos and drink Pepsis. And that was like, my dad would go to the monorail bar because that was the only place on the property anywhere that you could get, you know, a drink. And so he would go there and then wait and pick us up at the end of the day.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, that was fun. This was before the day. This was before the days of annual passes, kids. This is how we did it. So, and then, okay, you grow up in Orange County. You later worked at Disneyland, right? You became a Disneyland.
Right, teacher. Right.
Yeah. Like so many Imagineers I talked to, they actually started out as a lot of them started out as Disneyland cast members too, which is interesting. So where did you work? What did you do?
So my first training assignment was for the Columbia.
Oh.
Okay, which was kind of odd. Maybe just they either felt like I had some sailor in my past, which I'm not really sure about, or that there just happened to be an opening in the Columbia training schedule. And so I started at the Columbia, but soon after that I was trained on the Mark Twain, trained on the Jungle Cruise and Big Thunder Mountain. And I would have to say that after all that training, I spent an equal amount of time on the Jungle Cruise and on Big Thunder Mountain as a ride operator.
So I know the answer to this, but which was your favorite of those two?
Wow, it's a struggle because there was really no chance to really be a ham and express your sense of humor on Big Thunder Mountain.
Right. It's okay. Watch your head and step and, you know, point with two fingers and, you know, exit to the right. But Jungle Cruise, of course, that's a ride that's launched many a career.
Yeah. And it led to my getting hired, I think, as a Jeep tour guide in Sedona later on,
right.
Because I had that sort of smarmy tour guide sense of humor mm-hmm. that Jungle Cruise is famous for. And it worked right in as a pink Jeep tour guide.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. People don't know this, but Jake and I were both tour guides in Sedona also, but not at the same time. And we didn't know each other then, which was kind of weird.
And we worked for competing companies.
I actually worked for the Cowboy Jeep Tour Company, which is kind of interesting. I got to dress up in the full, you know, chaps and hat and the full regalia and that six gun and everything like that every day. And people would always say, is that hot? It looks really hot. And I'd be like, yeah, it is really hot. Get in the Jeep. So
one thing I did like about Big Thunder is I always appreciated the art direction that went into Rainbow Ridge. Obviously, liking trains and mining, you couldn't help but notice all the different mining equipment that's there.
Yeah, that's all real stuff they brought in too. They did a big search and found all the parts and the old rusty cogs and machines and brought them in there to decorate the set with. Mm-hmm. And the buildings, of course, are left over from the original mine train through Nature's Wonderland, the Rainbow Ridge Town.
Right.
Of course, the ones that are there now are all new. They rebuilt them a few years ago.
Sure.
And we'll be talking about that on a future episode. But So you were a cast member, and then you went and did other things. You were, you know, it's fascinating. You have a very diverse work history, not unlike myself. Done a lot of different things, you know, while casting around and trying to find your way in the world. You know, you were a cowboy performer for a while. I mean, you were in Tombstone, right?
Yeah, I was in Tombstone. They paid 30 of us to ride horses and shoot guns.
Wow.
And what a rough deal that is, right?
Right. So you get to play a cowboy, and you were one of the bad guys, the cowboy gang, right?
Like one of the Red Sash gang. Yes.
Right. And you said you were, I'm looking at my notes here. You were a gun wrangler gun and horse wrangler on that show. So you
was a gun wrangler. And I made some leather goods for the show, holsters and belts and some other things. I was not a cowboy wrangler per se. Those guys were doing some different work.
Okay. All right.
I was just taking care of my own horse.
And you had a speaking part that was cut.
Yeah. With my favorite line, I think it's time to start working for a living. And this is when the Earps are chasing the Red Sash Gang at the very end of the movie on the Vendetta ride. Right. And we're trying to get away from them. And Clanton turns to me and says, "There's only four of them. Kill them, kill them." And I spur my horse and take off and say, "It's time to start working for a living." And mayhem ensues, and cowboys are being shot, and horses are running fast.
That's a great line. Why did they? We'll never know why that.
So fitting.
And you rode in the. You rode a horse in the Rose Parade.
Yes, that's right. For about 6 years with the John Wayne Cancer Institute group and Phil Spangenberger's Wild West Riders.
Right. And he was also in Tombstone, right?
Phil? No, Phil was not in Tombstone.
He wasn't?
No. I'm sure he had something to do with it, but he was not in it. There's a few people who should have been in it. Phil probably should have been in it. Yeah. Jim Dunham is credited in the movie, but he's not in it.
Oh.
So, there's some unusual stories.
Huh. Well, anytime I make a mistake, I can go back and edit that out later. I'll just, I'll just cut that part out. So you did that, and then you found a career building models. Now, when I say senior dimensional designer for Walt Disney Imagineering, people don't know what that means. It means you built you worked in the model shop, right?
That's right.
They have all kinds of grandiose sounding titles for, for these jobs, but you were a senior dimensional designer. Tell the story how you got into Imagineering.
Well, it's partly interesting to figure out how I didn't get in there at first, but I had put together a portfolio and had made a connection with a woman who ran the department, Nancy Hickman, and I interviewed with her and showed her pictures of all the model making that I'd done. Mm-hmm. Well, it was clear, I think, to her that I didn't have the professional experience I needed, and so they passed. And I'm kind of glad they did, because I realized between the time I interviewed with her the first time and the time I interviewed with her the second time, I had learned quite a bit in quite a few different professional settings that really made me a much better candidate for that position. Shortly after that, I met a woman who worked at Mattel Toys. And because I wanted to work at a model shop, I just happened to blurt out, "Well, does Mattel have a model shop?" And she said, yes, they do. And so I went and worked for her and worked for Mattel and built a lot of miniature sets for Barbie and Hot Wheels. Found some work in stop motion animation through a Craigslist ad where I was able to build a lot of miniature sets for puppet shows for Robot Chicken and some other shows like that.
Yeah, speaking of Star Wars, you did the Robot Chicken Star Wars stuff, the sets for that, right?
Yes. That was the first time I was on the robot on the Star Wars payroll.
That's great.
I kind of joke about that. I've been on the Star Wars payroll twice now. Robot Chicken did Robot Chicken Star Wars. One of the perks was we got to go to the Skywalker Ranch.
Ooh.
And watch our show. We got to watch Empire Strikes Back. and we got to tour his library and vineyard area on the range.
Did you meet George?
He was there. He introduced the film.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was pretty exciting.
That's cool. Oh.
Anyway, one of our stop motion shows took a hiatus. And so I started to contact some friends that I had made through animation projects that were also working at Imagineering. And they were looking for people to build models. And I had the right experience. I knew people. And mm-hmm. I got started. And I have to say, it sounded like a real perfect situation and a really good fit. And so I was able to do that for quite a few years. Yeah. Worked on Shanghai, Pirates of the Caribbean, Star Wars, Disneyland,
right.
Galaxy's Edge.
Right. Well, you know, it's always interesting to me to hear the stories about how people get into Imagineering, because there's no one way. You know, there's a lot of people come from all different disciplines, and it's important. I think going back to your work history, it's important to have that kind of broad, experience. To draw upon, because if you're just a Disney nerd, if that's all you're interested in, then it becomes kind of like this worm eating its own tail. You know, it's like you have to have real world stuff to be able to draw on, to be able to make that magic in that in the phony world.
Sure, sure, absolutely.
Don't you think? So let's talk about the Big Thunder model.
The
Big Thunder model. See, that's one of my favorite things that you've done, because we have a connection there. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, see, you, me, and Sam are like the Rainbow Ridge Modelers Club, the secret Rainbow Ridge Modelers
Rainbow
Club.
Rainbow Ridge Modelers Association.
I think we've all.
We should have jackets made.
Yeah, we should, and there's got to be a separate handshake. Right. And maybe we wear a different color hanky in the back pocket of our overalls, but. That model, it's interesting because I've always had a fascination with wanting to recreate bits and pieces of that attraction, right, based on the fact that I worked on it and it kind of struck a chord with me with all the things Western and all the things mining. So I had started collecting some photographs of the original attraction. Someone reached out to me years prior and said, Jake, can you build a Big Thunder Mountain model for my man cave? And of course I said, sure. And in the process of negotiation, it all fell apart. But I guess that was probably meant that this next project was meant to be. I heard rumor that they were going to call one of the towers at Disneyland the Frontierland Tower, and they wanted a quarter-inch scale model of the Big Thunder attraction
in the
lobby.
Right.
I found out about this, and I made every connection inquiry I could to pitch myself to build this. I thought there was no one better here to do this than me. I know the ride inside and out. I know the modeling materials and suppliers inside and out.
Right.
I love this. I've been thinking about it for a long time, and to actually get paid to do it, that's awesome.
That's a dream job. Right. And so you took hundreds of pictures but the mountain itself, the spire, wasn't that cast from the Tony Baxter original?
Yes. So because Tony Baxter was the original Imagineer behind Big Thunder, he had a plaster cast. Maybe it wasn't a casting, but he had a plaster sculpture of the main Big Thunder spire in his home.
Mm-hmm.
He was still around Imagineering at the time when we were doing this, so we were able to contact him, get the model brought up here, and have it 3D scanned.
Right.
So the main spire was 3D scanned, and then it was delivered to us in 6-pound urethane foam.
Right.
Still needed a little cleanup, but the fact that we didn't have to go to the trouble of trying to make it and actually have the actual representation was really ideal.
Right. So you didn't have to try to start over from scratch.
Right. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that we weren't left without some challenges around the rest of the model, because that was done from scratch.
Right.
And a lot of the rock work that you see had to be done from photographs and sort of done on the fly to get as close to the sculpture that you see there. So it wasn't without some challenges, but it made the hero identifiable piece very accurate.
Right, right. Well, the whole thing is amazing to look at. And folks, if you've not been to the Disneyland Hotel in Anaheim, California, please go and check out this model. It's in the lobby of the Frontierland Tower. You can't miss it. You walk in and it's there. It's pretty amazing. There's a great story about Bob Iger, though, that associated with this. Didn't he want the trains to move?
Yeah, Bob Iger wanted to know what it was going to take to get those trains to run on the model. And I can't remember what the answer was that was directly given to him, but I know that we all kind of looked at each other and kind of said, well, no.
Because it wasn't built as a working model. I mean, the tunnels don't even go anywhere, right? The track just basically ends at the at the tunnels.
It ended the tunnels, but to make something like that and to make the physics
right
of a scale model do what a real roller coaster does is just not possible. And the all the systems that make that work in terms of timing would just be very difficult to electrically engineer for a small model like that. That's really not my forte. I'm sure somebody said, oh, sure, we could knock that out. Go right ahead.
Right. That's what a lot of people don't understand, is that when you scale something down, the physics don't change. The physics are still one scale. So if you're trying to build a scale roller, this is why they always look wrong or move too fast or something. They always look weird. It's the same thing if you see like in old movies, if you like watch old Ray Harryhausen animated films. So like if there's water or fire, you know, it looks a little off. And that's because the water or fire is full size. Those things you can't really scale down. You can do it now with CG, but back in the day, you couldn't really do it. And the same thing is true with modeling physics. So if you build a model roller coaster, the physics are totally different than on a full, well, actually, they're exactly the same as a full-size roller coaster, and that's why it doesn't work in scale as well. So, but, you know, let's talk about the Disneyland Railroad. You know, they recently changed the route recently. This is like 2 years ago, 3 years ago now, and put some new bridges in and waterfalls and all that kind of stuff. And you worked on the bridges for that. Is that right?
Well, I saw that some bridges were coming up, and I really pride myself on having maybe not all the knowledge about model railroad bridges, but at least enough to add something to the conversation that most folks at Imagineering don't really pay attention to. And so I brought in some photographs of railroad bridges, one of them being the Hermosa Creek Trestle. That's a Hal truss that goes across a stream there on the Durango-Silverton Railroad. And I brought that picture in. They liked it. I made a model of it. Sam Toler later made a much larger, highly detailed model of it in half-inch scale for the park. And all of a sudden, it's like, wow, something that was sort of near and dear to me as a little railroad bridge is now at the park.
Right. That's really cool.
Pretty cool.
And if you're at the park, go ahead.
Moving on down the line, you see another bridge where there's a big waterfall. It's a long trestle.
Right.
Initially, the designers wanted to use the same trestle bents that were in Critter Country, which were basically two round logs and an X brace. And I convinced them that they should look more closely at the pictures of Walt's railroad that was in his Carrollwood backyard. And they were a 4 or 5 post trestle bent. And I built a model of that. And then later, larger models were built of it. And they were convinced that that was the direction to go.
Yeah.
On that bridge as well.
But just for the record, the murder beavers were not your idea, right? The beavers that are chewing through the to kill all the passengers on the train.
Those evil beavers.
Murder beavers for some reason. But some people in the Disney fan community, they are called murder beavers, which is, I think is hilarious. So that was not your idea.
No, no. I would think that there would be a little bit of a quake as each train passed by.
Right. Yeah, it's again, physics. It's a cute gag. I thought it was a very kind of Mark Davis-esque kind of gag. But yeah, that's and for people who don't know, the Howe Truss he's talking about, that's the bridge you pass under if you're going into Galaxy's Edge from the Critter Countryside. You go under that and you go wind around through the woods there into Blackspire Outpost. And you worked on the model for that too, Galaxy's Edge, right?
I worked on the first pilot model for Galaxy's Edge, and it was a very simplified gray model where we identified where retail and shopping areas were and dining areas. We established where the ride box buildings were located and some of the larger rock formations. Mm-hmm. And it also showed the first sort of inward bend of the Disneyland Railroad track loop.
To show that it could actually be done. You know? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's, you know, it had to be really hard to keep a secret about that.
You know, we all like to talk about this stuff, but I knew better. And I think I had kind of found out early on that Disney was telling people more about these projects coming up than I was finding out at work.
Right.
So I felt like if I wanted to
on Twitter or something, then you would find out right at work. That brings up an interesting thing. Something I always wanted to ask you: What was a typical day like at Imagineering? People want to know this. What's it like? What's a day in the life going in there?
Well, you know, I don't know if it's a day as much as a project life cycle that's probably more important to discuss. And there ends up being some initial meetings about, hey, we'd like you and your crew to build this model. Right. Okay, great. So you start to discuss the parameters of what scale, what materials, what things are going to be represented in what way, whether they're going to be sculpted out of foam, built out of plastic or wood, 3D printed. And so it becomes, so this is what starts, and then all of a sudden drawings start to come in. And so you start to build. And as you build, the designers come in and they start to look at what you've done.
Right.
And they suggest changes, which is just inevitable. That's kind of part of the process.
That's kind of why you do the model, right?
Yeah, you're trying to make sure all the stuff they're thinking about works. And then all of a sudden, if you see something that hasn't been figured out on paper, they can go back and edit their designs on paper and make it match what their intentions are. You're also getting, with these drawings, some concept illustration, some random research photographs. For example, for Pirates, I bought several books on ship rigging. So I understood that. I went to some ship museums where they had miniature ships up in Oxnard. It was a naval theme museum. And so I took pictures of lots of ship models. At the same time, at the Nixon Library, no, I'm sorry, the Reagan Library, the Simi Valley, they had some models from Pirates of the Caribbean, and so I was able to photograph them.
Cool.
Got some great detail, and then went to the Columbia ship at the park and photographed several different pieces of that ship, and then the Lady Washington ship came into Oxnard. I was able to take pictures of that. So having that research is important. As you're getting these drawings, you start to build, more people look at it, and then all of a sudden, the project starts to get painted, and the painters come in, and they paint it.
Right.
Then the models go in a crate after everyone's had a chance to see them, right. And the process starts over again.
And you're on to the next project.
Yeah, on to the next Hopefully. Project. I'm trying to think. I know I glossed over a lot of things that have happened because there's you know, a lot of the sculpture would get 3D scanned before it was turned into rockwork surfaces and structural steel.
Right.
We would make miniature props, cannons, furniture, mm-hmm. different things that were going to have to be.
Right. And don't the models also get larger in scale as you get closer to the final version? I mean, once everything's finalized, don't they build a much larger, like half inch or whatever, a different scale? Because it starts out pretty small.
Yeah, we start building models of entire lands in right. like 1 to 100 scale or even smaller, 1 to 200 scale. And they're very simple massing models. And depending on the origin of the park that it's being built for, it'll be built in either a metric scale or a U.S., what do we call that, imperial scale?
Imperial. Now, that's a wrinkle I never thought about. You've got to translate it for the overseas parks into the metric system or vice versa. That's interesting.
I have a lot of different scale rulers left over from working at Imagineering.
I bet you do.
They're in a box. So you've got to figure out if it's for Disneyland Paris or Shanghai Disneyland. We've got to build this to a metric scale. And so these small models get built at like very small architectural scales, 1 to 100 or smaller. They might do a quarter inch model or an eighth inch model or a 1 to 50 model.
Wow. Okay.
And then all of a sudden you get to the final art director's model, which for US is a half inch. To the foot.
Right.
Now, we've done some other models in different metric scales for overseas. The Disneyland Shanghai Pirates of the Caribbean model, oh man, a figure was about 7 inches tall. Metrically, somebody's going to know exactly what this was off the top of my head. It slipped my mind. But we built that to a scale so that your head was the size of a ride vehicle.
Wow. So you could walk through it and see it at eye level, right?
Right. And so your head is the ship and your propulsion method through our model was not walking. You were sitting on a mechanic stool and you were scooting through the model. And I got to tell you, all you had to do was have some music and some spray bottles. And the whole experience would have been as much e-ticket as you would have needed just to go through our little model.
That's great.
I don't know if that will catch on in the future for micro-sized theme parks, but...
I should do that on the Thunder Mesa layout. I should, get a little mechanic stool and just push people through and hum in their ear as I go,
That's right.
Yeah, Turkey in the Straw or some sort of Western banjo tune.
Yeah, and a little spray bottle and maybe light a match when you're in the dynamite cave or something so that you smell the...
The smell-o-rama. Right. Yes. I wanted to do a thing. In fact, I might do this for Halloween next year. Spoiler alert. Is that there's an open grave on Boot Hill, and I want to put a little air jet in there. Because people always lean over to look in, and I want to just have a little jump scare thing just a little right in their face as they look down.
Can't you just put a
guy jump out?
A little skeleton on a rod, and you plunge it's a plunger, and you push it, and bam, he pops up.
He jumps up. We got to make that happen.
You've got to have a scream that goes with it at the same time because, visual and a scream is kind of sensory overload, gives you the scare. It's part of the magic.
Exactly. A little pop-up ghost.
Yes. That would be great. Pop-up screaming ghost.
Pop-up screaming ghost. Here's another thing. You did the Peter Pan clock tower.
Yes.
One that's when they redid Peter Pan. That's your work is the clock tower in
there. There's a new clock tower up there, yeah.
Where they project Wendy and Peter and everybody in the you didn't do that part, but you built the physical.
Right. The clock and the imagery that's in the clock face is all projected on there.
On there. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, and there's a hidden Mickey on the tower.
Right.
courtesy of the painters. I think it was there in the previous tower.
Uh-huh.
And then they...
And they carried it over.
They carried it over, yeah.
A lot of it's tradition. Yeah, you got to keep those. You got to keep those traditions alive.
And a lot of that tower, well, a portion of the roof tower is built with perforated metal to hide the speakers.
Mm-hmm. That's a whole art form unto itself, is hiding.
hiding the theme park speakers, yes.
Right. Right. Exactly.
Yeah, so that was built out of speaker or perforated steel for a speaker enclosure inside the tower.
That's great. So what is your favorite project you ever worked on?
I would have to say Pirates.
Pirates?
Yeah, Pirates. Yeah. Because I got to see that through from an early phase all the way to completion. And one of the final sort of aha moments for working on that was we took the models over to Shanghai for a Bob Iger Chinese government presentation.
Right.
And while we were there on one of our off days, we got to walk through the Shanghai Pirates attraction as it was being built.
Wow.
And so we're sitting here in Glendale, towering over these, 4 foot ships, four foot, 6 foot pirate ships. And all of a sudden we go to Shanghai and we walk through the scene, right. And these ships are 3 stories, 4 stories tall.
Mm-hmm.
And they look just like the model we built.
That's
got
to be amazing to experience. There's something you worked on and then you go and there it is, real, in real life. That's got to be a lot of fun. That's got to be very gratifying.
Well, and it's interesting to come full circle, because you and I, as model railroaders, we like to look at the real thing and make a model of it.
Shrink it down, right.
So here it is in complete opposite. We've made a model of it, and now we're going to see our model being recreated full life size.
That's amazing.
You finally realize the scope of what you're working on and what it is about to become.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pretty awesome.
Well, that's pretty fun. I could see why people want to do that for a living.
I think it's time to start working for a living. Wait a minute.
Nice way to bring it around there. Very good. So another huge influence I know in your life, speaking of trains, is Colorado Narrow Gauge, right? I mean,
yes.
The Durango and Silverton and the Coomers and Toltec and those remaining bits and pieces of the Colorado narrow gauge empires there. It's like, that's how has that influenced in your life? Because I know you model an SN3, or your dream railroad will be an SN3 when you
when I build my railroad.
When your ship comes in and you can build it. You know what I want to do with you? I just decided, going back to what we're just, one of these days we need to go Shanghai and ride that. Wouldn't that be fun?
Oh, Dave, that would be, that when Crescent Creek Models finally reaches but,
yeah,
the...
Yeah, when we're, you know, when we're flush, we could go do that. That would be a blast.
Wouldn't it?
Except there's no train in that park, and that bothers me. That fills me with an existential angst that there's no train.
I think the whole Chinese Americans and the railroads probably did not tie in very well with the politically sensitive Chinese theme Disneyland. So
yeah, I understand the reasons, but it still bothers me. I'll get over it someday.
Yeah. Just ride the train here a few more times. So getting back to one of my first trips to Durango,
yeah.
My father said, hey, we're going to go ride a narrow gauge train. And gee, I didn't know what that was. All I could do was imagine that it was smaller than a full size train. But when you're 5 or 6, scale is kind of relative, it looked very much like a full-size train, and it happened at an age when trains had already sort of captured my my imagination by going to places like Knott's, going to places like Disneyland. And all of a sudden you're seeing this train to get on for the first time, and you start to take that ride through this beautiful scenery and past these old places that haven't been overdeveloped yet. And you're like, this is like a little microcosm of traveling across the West.
Right. Right.
And you get to a mining town as your sort of lunchtime destination, filled with cowboys in the streets wanting to perform a gunfight, and and old Western buildings that looked like they were in a movie, which I'm sure they probably were in the 1950s. Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's this whole sort of Western theme situation or scenario, and this whole railroad theme thing. It's been a, you keep trying to take yourself back to that moment in your modeling and your interest and your understanding of railroads to that initial influence, and figure out how can I experience more of this? How can I flesh out these things that were exciting to me as a kid and and recreate?
Recapture that magical feeling, you know, that, that's what I call it on the stunt. People say, oh god, man, because you know, I'm kind of obsessive, like we all are. I know, I'm shocked too. The Thunder Mesa, the whole big Thunder Mesa layout is like, wow, man, this must have taken a long time. Said, yeah, it takes time, but you know, it's the purpose of it is to bring delight. It's to be delightful. That's the only reason it exists. It's to recreate that feeling you were just talking about, that, you know, Christmas morning, that that childlike sense of, ooh, you know, that's really cool. You do it just, that's what I've always liked about Imagineering, especially in the old days. So many things, and this struck me even as a kid, it's like, they didn't have to do this. You know, they didn't have to spend the extra money to do this. It was done simply because it's delightful, because it's cool. You know, this was put here just because it's a neat thing to do, you know, and that, and I was like, well, I like that philosophy. I think that's a great way to go through life. You know, it's, we all chase the dollar and so on, but it's a lot of fun just to do things that are just doing because they're fun to do, which is what model railroading is all about. Model railroading is fun.
Well, we've seen the theme parks that have opted not to do those things and leave out that passionate sort of creative development of the story. And it kind of leaves you, I don't want to say wanting more, but it kind of, it doesn't finish telling the story that you want to see.
Right.
And Disney does that the best.
Right.
Any great model railroader that's put their passion into their layout building for storytelling shares that same connection.
Right.
We as Imagineers and as model railroaders are storytellers.
Right.
And some of us are obviously better at it than others. Some of us put more effort in it. Some people are trying to tell different stories.
Mm-hmm.
Like how many cars were in that train and what time did it arrive on a certain day and what was the weather like? But I digress.
That was the engineer's name.
Right. Yeah. Those people remain nameless. But, you know, it's storytelling, and it's wanting to, like you say, create delight in the things that you enjoyed as a child. And I think everyone who has a hobby or a passion that's developed out of their childhood, even if it's not modeling or Disney, can all relate, whether it's being into cars or horses or some kind of sport or some other pursuit.
Right, right. And going back to your point, it's like that some parks do it and some parks don't. And you may not realize it if you're not, you know, into that kind of thing like you and I are, and we notice all the details. But you know when it's not there. You can feel when it's not there. You miss it when it's not there. And that finishing the story is a good way to put it, or fleshing out the world is what I like to say. You know, you got to world building. You got to flesh out the
world. Yes.
You know, that's great. That's great. So how did you get started in model kit building?
Kit design and laser cutting
and all that fun stuff. How'd you get started in that?
Well, many of us started building HO Craftsman structure kits at a young age. I'm sure you share the same path.
The building good old the old Campbell scale kits in the plant boxes. Yes.
My mother took me as a Boy Scout, our troop, to Campbell scale models as kind of a field trip.
Yeah.
And while I don't remember much of anything there than a bunch of boxes on the shelves, they showed you how they painted all the little Weston figures, but the smell of that sweet pine that they made all their models out of really kind of left an impression on me.
Right.
So obviously you learn that, you learn some scratch building, and you realize in the process of scratch building that the next step is to design it, because you either scratch build with plans or you make the plans to build from. And being an SN3 modeler without a lot of kits out there, I wanted to start designing and building some things that that weren't available in my scale or weren't available at all.
Period, right.
So one of the contacts I made was Jimmy Simmons at Monster Model Works.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a laser and he was making S scale kits. And so I became friends with him very quickly.
Right.
Another contact was another Imagineer who was doing some laser work. His name was Mike Bishop.
Right.
And Mike Bishop showed me how to use Adobe Illustrator. Boy, I'm thankful every day that he had the patience to get me started and hooked up on that.
Right.
Thanks, Mike. And he showed me how to run the Epilogue laser machine.
Mm.
So I obviously wanted to start cutting stuff, and it took a while for me to get signed up for the key code to get into the laser room at Imagineering.
Uh-huh.
But what I soon found out was I was spending more time on the computer designing models and less time on the laser cutting them. So I realized, wow, you should practice drawing. And then, you know, when you get a chance, go cut some parts and see how it works and see if everything comes together. And what I really liked was designing and building that first one-of-a-kind model. And so as a result of me learning how to do all that stuff at Imagineering, I ended up taking on some different laser cutting projects for the projects I was working on. And so Star Wars needed something, or an Avatar model needed something. And so rather than going through the normal channels of having it go through the digital workflow and their department, I would find some of those tiny little projects to start and finish, and I could get them done for our project and make that happen. So that was a lot of fun, because I was taking my newly acquired skills and making model railroading more fun and making Imagineering more fun at the same time. So
That's great.
I feel fortunate, because professional model making has made my model railroading better. Model railroading has made my professional model making better.
Hmm.
So the two of them have kind of worked hand in hand.
Yeah. Well, that's great. And so now you design kits for Crescent Creek Models, which is a little company you started with this goofy guy in Arizona.
Imagine that.
Now, I should let you say, we're getting close to time here, and I want to talk about, before we go, how you and I met originally and how we got started in all this, because it's an interesting story, I guess. I mean, it was, we were at Fullerton Railroad days, right?
Right, right. And you and I were aware of each other's whereabouts prior to that. And
right.
So you being a fan of Imagineering, me being a fan of your Big Thunder, your Thunder Mesa Railroad, it just seemed like a natural connection for us to become friends and work on this together. So
yeah, it's a shame we don't get along at all. No, you said
we have under our belt.
It wasn't then. It was at another function later on at a mutual friend's house, and you said, "You know, we should get together and collaborate on something someday." And I'm like, "Yeah, great. What?" And you said, "I have no idea."
That's the best part. I think the fact that I kind of said that and forgot about it, and you had to remind me of it.
Right.
It's just kind of ironic intuition for us to be in this situation together.
The whole Walt's Barn thing came up. So we it's a great way to launch into the whole thing. The 20th anniversary of Walt's Barn at the Griffith Park.
We're very grateful for those customers.
It was nice that we
What's that?
It occurred to me that the timing was nice with the 20th anniversary of Griffith Park, and if we were going to do something,
And we did.
And that worked out okay. So, all right. Anything else you want to get into while I got you on the line here? Did we cover everything? There's got to be more.
I think we covered it. I made a little list right before you and I started, and I think we pretty much covered it.
Oh. All right. The hell with you then.
I gotta go. I'm done.
So what's coming next from Crescent Creek Models?
Crescent Creek Models. Plug something. We are in research and design for the HO scale Walt Disney Carolwood Barn.
Yes.
We are in research and design for a Birdcage Theater of Tombstone fame.
Arizona, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think my partner Dave has a calico structure in the works.
The calico mine in O scale, yeah, is on its way. It's coming.
And a few more that we just haven't gotten to the bottom of yet. But Crescent Creek promises to be really busy next year.
Yeah, it's 2021 is going to be a great year. As we say that every year at New Year's. I remember saying that. In 2009, boy, 2020 is going to be great.
The trials of the year.
The trials of the year.
Yes.
Well, Jake, I want to thank you again so much for doing this, for being on the very first episode of the Thunder Mesa Limited podcast. And, I really appreciate it. Appreciate you taking the time. It's great talking to you. It's always great talking to you. This is how we talk all the time, by the way, when we're just like on the phone. We get off on these tangents and say, oh, wouldn't it be cool to do this? We should do this. And, that's what happens. It's fun.
Good times.
It's like if we were kids, we'd be building a treehouse right now, in the backyard somewhere. We'd be out there with hammer and nail and stealing pallets from a construction site in order to build a treehouse. And
it would be the ultimate themed treehouse.
It would be really cool. There'd be tiki birds and a train and everything else. All right, my friend, it's great talking to you. Thank you so much. And I will be talking with you again real soon. All right?
Sounds great, Dave. My pleasure. Thank you.
Adios. And that is going to do it for this time, amigos. Thank you so much for tuning in. And a huge thanks again to our very first guest, your friend and mine, Jake Johnson. And I hope you'll join us for episode 2, which is coming up in February, when my very special guest will be former Walt Disney Imagineering Executive Creative Director, Ray Spencer. Ray is a leader in the field of themed entertainment, as well as a huge Disney trained nerd, just like you and me. It's going to be fun talking with him. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss a single episode. And you can do that via direct RSS feed at thundermesa.studio/podcasts or on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever fine podcasts are streaming. If you want to help get Thunder Mesa Studios podcasts and videos on the air, please consider joining our Patreon campaign. Our patrons get early access and exclusive content for as little as $3 a month. Find out more at patreon.com/thundermesa. And now, folks, I've got a train to catch. Keep moving forward, amigos. Adios for now.